Hey everyone, it's Chris again from Charity Digital. Welcome to the last session of Digital Fundraising Day 2019. I know, sad faces all round, but all good things have to come to an end, unfortunately. I'm sure there's people weeping at their desks all over the UK at the moment. But seriously, thank you all for joining us today and being part of our very first virtual conference. It's been a fantastic day, and we had over 1,300 registrants and some fantastic speakers. To round us off today, I'm joined by Charity Digital CEO and familiar voice by now, Jonathan Chevalier.
Hello.
And new voice making her podcast debut, consultant Emily McKenzie.
Hello, hi.
Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
We're here to chat about our wonderful ebook, The Future of Money Making for Charities, which is available to all those who signed up for the day. And you can download it now from the digitalfundraisingday.org.uk agenda page. The idea for this came from several conversations we've been having both inside and outside the office. And the general thought has been that digital technology has revolutionised the way people shop, sell and donate, which creates an environment in which giving to charity is not always a priority for many. Willing donors are often not presented with an opportunity to give. And the donation options are on offer aren't always suitable. So to not only be successful but sustainable, we feel like the sector as a whole needs to find a new way to raise more funds and ultimately connect better with supporters, allowing them to donate how, where and when they like. And that's where this ebook comes to play. Emily, you've played a big part in pulling this all together. Why don't you kick us off with an overview of what you thought?
Sure. I think as you said, the changes in digital and the changes in the behaviour of supporters have necessitated charities looking differently at fundraising. And in fact, probably thinking of it in its broadest possible sense, perhaps more even as financing rather than simply fundraising. Taking a step back and really considering the widest possible array of revenue streams that their charity could benefit from and that they could deliver on. And that's very much the tone that the ebook takes. It looks at a very wide range of different finance opportunities.
Yeah, I'd kind of build on that. I guess when I was reading the ebook, because I didn't actually write this one, so I was consuming it for the first time as a consumer, I was really struck by two things. The first thing was this question of, why should Charity Digital have an opinion on this? And to me, it went straight to what you said. You know, the world that we're operating in has changed significantly, and the opportunities around digital mean that maybe there's a necessity to actually look at your funding, your financing differently. And the second thing which really stood out for me was the importance of thinking about this strategically. So we're very used in Charity Digital to say, when you think about digital strategy, you need to first think about strategy and then think about what the role of digital is. And in some ways, financing is similar. So don't start off by going, we need to fundraise by running a public campaign on a fundraising website. Start off by saying, what are we actually trying to achieve as an organisation? What is the best vehicle to achieve that? And by the way, that might not be a charitable vehicle. That might be a community interest company or some other type of vehicle. And how is that vehicle best funded? Mm-hmm. And this ebook really goes into exploring what some of those different funding models could be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the other thing is the importance of factoring in both the behaviour, both of donors and of beneficiaries, and how you can best meet their needs, where you will find them and how you can serve them. And that does seem to be shifting also, so that's important.
So we kick off the ebook with social investment, which is additional funding provided to charities to achieve some larger scale projects. Organisations then take the surplus that they've gained from those opportunities to pay back investors. Now, looking into this, it's a bit of a minefield, so I think the best place to start is just kind of defining what exactly is social investment.
Yeah, I think it's an important thing to do. And one of the first things I want to cover is what I see as some of the confusion between ethical investing, impact investing, and social investing. There is some overlap here, but I think it's important to try and get some clear definition. So let's start with ethical investing. So ethical investing is typically investing in mainstream companies for a commercial return and looking to avoid social damage, and favouring those that have conscious positive impact policies. So typical examples here of an ethical investor won't invest in a tobacco company, won't invest in a fossil fuel company or an arms company. So they'll look for companies that are trying to deliver returns, maybe have some social policies within those companies, but they're not really at the forefront. It's kind of the absence of the negative, so the damage that they're really looking for. Then when we go to the impact investor, there's a change of focus. So the impact investor is definitely looking for a significant financial return on their investment, but they're looking for it from a company that is trying to make an impact. So the great example here is Tesla. So Tesla is trying to make an impact by effectively doing away with the carbon combustion engine, having all electric vehicles, much less pollution, benefits to the environment. And through doing that, they're aiming to deliver a massive financial return to their investors. So impact investors, yes, they want a social impact, but equally as important, they want an above average financial return from doing that. Then we go to the social investor. The social investor's primary purpose is to achieve a social impact. So they are investing their money to achieve that impact. They're prepared to take a slightly lower return, but they're not giving that money away. If they were giving that money away, they'd just be a donor. But they're an investor, so they are at least hoping to get their original investment back, hopefully with some kind of return on top of that, but not at the same levels that the ethical investor or the impact investor is looking for.
So one of the biggest social investors in the charity sector in this space is Big Issue Invest, which is a social investment arm of the Big Issue Group, who, you know, provide these loans and investment opportunities to other charities and social enterprises in the UK. To date, they've invested almost $30 million in 300 social ventures. It shows there's clearly an appetite for this on both the investor and investee side. But it does come with a lot of risk. How can charities get started here? How can they make themselves more attractive to these social investors?
Well, I suppose the thing to remember about social investment is that it is a repayable form of finance, and that's really important. So, and typically also with some level of interest, although it might be low. So in order to be attractive to investors, it's the same sort of preparatory processes that you go through in order to make yourself attractive for any kind of loan, in terms of, you know, reviewing repayments, making sure that they're affordable, reviewing the overall cost of finance, making sure that your accounts don't have any red flags in them, making sure that you can evidence income, propensity to continue to generate income. And I suppose the other thing is to be clear about what the investment is there to fund. I think it's probably best used to fund a specific project of some sort, you know, something that will help your organisation to upscale or to achieve something different, or to access different incomes. So I think those are the two most important things.
I think to go back to a point you mentioned earlier, Jonathan, as well, I think you can pull this all back to strategy. And I think having a clear outline and a clear sort of strategic overlook of what you want to achieve to be able to present to someone, to an investor or a social investor in this instance, puts you on the front foot as well.
Yeah, I think the big thing that really stands out here is the investor needs to get their original investment back. So there needs to be a model that is going to deliver that money back. And because of the risk element, that model needs to be one that kind of has very well-defined risk in it. So the types of models that are going to fund the most easily here are actually things like trading models. So, for example, if I'm providing a service which is maybe looking after children in, let's say, southwest of England, and that service is going really well and it's being commissioned by local government, and I believe I can extend that service more, so to help more children across the country, then it's working well, it's delivering, it's covering its costs, it's maybe delivering a small surplus, then it should be possible for me to go to a social funder and say, look, I've done my work, I've identified that a service like this could be used really well in the Midlands, I'd like to extend it to the Midlands, but I need some finances to get it going. But because you can look at how well it's worked in the Southwest, you can be confident that if you fund this, that you're going to have a good chance of getting your initial investment back. And from the small surplus it'll generate, it'll be able to pay you the interest charge that you'd like to make as well.
I suppose the only other thing worth saying is around risk and thinking through and preparing for the possibility that you may not be able to make the repayments and having a clear plan in order to tackle that if it happens.
Yeah, good point.
Microsoft 365 can be a cost-effective alternative to maintaining software or servers. Hosting all the business applications you're used to in the cloud lets you easily and securely access your important files and tools from anywhere in the world. Charities can now get their first 10 Microsoft 365 licenses absolutely free. Find out more at charitydigitalexchange.org.
So moving on to chapter two, we focus on community share capital here, which is a withdrawable share capital that can only be issued by cooperative societies, community benefit societies, and charitable community benefit societies. Since 2009, almost 120,000 people have invested in over £100 million to support 350 community businesses throughout the UK. But I think what makes this a really attractive model for the right organisations is that the funding comes from like-minded individuals linked to a common cause with similar motivations. But when does it make sense for an organisation to adopt this model?
Yeah, it's interesting comparing this to the social investment we were talking about earlier, because to me there are some pretty significant differences. One of the most significant is that whereas the social investment might work really well for funding the expansion of an existing service, to me this works best when there's a purchase of an asset at the core of it. So it could be... it could be a heritage asset that people want to keep and preserve for the benefit of the community. Or it could actually be an asset that you need to deliver a service. But that asset, you know, you could rent that at vast cost. And so it would really be expensive to provide it. You know, and a simple example is if you need a building to deliver your service. We all know property is expensive. So if you could actually get that building funded through community shares, then you don't have to pay rent and the whole cost of providing that service becomes much, much lower. So it's really great for that. But one of the other big differences in this type of example, people put their money in and shouldn't have an expectation of a return back. In actual fact, the people who often put their money in are also the customers of that enterprise.
Probably its supporters in a wider sense too.
Yeah. There's one I'm kind of close to. It's not very charitable at all, but it's the Wine Society. It's owned totally by its members. To be able to buy any of their wine, you have to buy a share. And when you die, you can sell that share, or your successors can sell that share, but they won't get a profit on that. They'll just get back what they initially put in. But the money from those shares went in way, way back to actually setting up what's actually become quite a big business, like a £100 million plus business, and now trades successfully, but actually trades with a very different value set to any other retailer because their only benefit is for their members at the end of the day.
And I suppose that, to me, that plays on the other key thing about this model, which is, and it says it in the title, but it is that it plays to a community. So it's a community with a shared aim and a long-term interest in achieving that aim. And I think that's really important. The example I particularly liked was around the rebuilding of the Hastings Pier, which, you know, obviously needed to be achieved, and those most likely to benefit were the local community. And that scheme actually sold out. There were people who wanted to buy shares and couldn't, and it raised over £500,000 for the community and for the project, which was goes to show what a community can achieve in very quick order.
Yeah, so I think for me this can be a really great vehicle, but the thing that needs to be borne in mind is that you need to set up some specific legal structures to be able to implement one of these. They're not massively complex at the end of the day, but you will need obviously some specialist advice to do that.
Absolutely, yeah. The regulation is significant. So you need a lawyer and probably an accountant.
Some great points there. With Chapter 3, we don't just look at the general startup, you know, VC seed funding, but we talk more about patient capital, otherwise known as long-term capital. And essentially what this is, and this is why it's a useful model for charities, is that an investor is willing to make a significant investment with no expectation for a quick return. We've seen an influx of these over the last year or so now that companies are becoming more socially responsible with their operations. And, you know, a lot of charities are benefiting from that.
Yes, I think this is an interesting model, but it's got some interesting contrasts and differences to our early discussion on social investment. And I think this is very much driven by the risk equation. So when we're thinking about something that's starting up, it's kind of inherently more risky. You know, it's got no established revenue streams. It hasn't got any established operations. So it's kind of having to create all of that from scratch. And that makes it more risky. And lots of startups fail at the end of the day. That's just a sad fact of life. And that is going to tend to make an investor view it differently. So regardless of whether it's kind of like a traditional VC or patient capital itself, they are going to want a higher rate of return on their investment. So whereas they might have been happy to settle with 2, 3, 4, 5% investing on extending an existing operation, which we were talking about earlier with Chapter 1, here they're going to need a much bigger return to actually, one, give them their investment back, and two, to actually fund some of the ventures that fail. Now, some of the social investors who are in this space might still be more charitable in that and go, I don't need a 10 times return, which is what your typical VC is going to be looking for. But they're still going to want, I think, more than 3, 4, 5%. And there are real implications of that, because that means that you're probably going to have to create this as some kind of separate equity-backed organization that is going to, over time, assume its own life. So for a charity considering one of these, you've got to get comfortable with that as a concept, that you're going to have to create maybe a separate company, but you can have a share in that company, you can have some control over that, but at some point you might have to set that free in order for it to pay back its investors. And that might sound like a really terrible idea, terrible prospect to a charity, but if it's the option of don't do this at all because you can't get it off the ground because you've got no money, or do it but accept you're going to have to set it free at some point, then surely the do it and set it free at some point is the better option.
Absolutely. And this is a great way to fund an enterprise that may take some time to set up, but where you really believe you can generate something genuinely sustainable in the long term and with high reward for investors and, you know, and for all those involved. The other interesting thing I thought about this model is actually the way in which charities can think about structuring it, borrowing from that VC staged investment funding. So starting with some seed capital to sort of test the idea, and then moving on to a series of staged rounds, so that both I suppose the charity itself and the investors can mitigate their risk to a certain extent and test the idea before upscaling.
Yeah, and that's really important because although the investor has to accept more risk, they're still going to want to keep that managed. And the way they keep that managed is by ensuring that there are good proof points before they put money in. So doing the initial work, mm-hmm. which gets you from the drawing board to having some kind of, you know, proof that you can deliver this service and that maybe you can finance it. That's important. And how do you do that? Where do you get the money to do that? Typical places people look is, well, certainly entrepreneurs normally go to friends and family, hoping they've got enough money between them.
Or self-fund, in fact.
Yeah, remortgage their house. That's a pretty common one. But there are some institutional routes as well that are pretty good now as well. So there are the incubators and accelerators like Bethnal Green Ventures, who was specifically set up to look for investments of this type. And then there are some of the tech companies are doing some interesting work as well. So Microsoft run their AI for Good initiative, and charities can actually participate in this to start up new projects and concepts and test them out with Microsoft funding over a 3-month period. And when they get to the end of that 3 months, depending on what they've created, then they can kind of say, well, what's next? You know, is this something we can now self-fund, or is this something that we put into a separate organization and go get some patient capital or whatever? But I guess getting that initial money to get to that first point is really, really important. So you've got enough proof to then get more funding to go to the next stage.
Yeah, all fantastic points. And I think, you know, similar to previous chapters as well, this level of investment often goes sort of beyond the realms of just financial as well. You get, you know, being, you know, helped out by a Microsoft, by a, you know, a big tech company, you know, Bethnal Green Ventures, something like that.
Or possibly a partner that can help you get to market.
Exactly. You get a wealth of support that comes with it. And I think, you know, if done, planned right, risks assessed, I think there's a lot to be gained from something like this. But moving on to chapter 4.
Hey, it's Joel here from Charity Digital. For over 11 years, Charity Digital Mail has helped charities send over 51 million emails every year and provide the care and support to make sure every organisation is getting their messages to the right people, at the right place, at the right time. Ask us how we can help improve your email performance at charitydigitalmail.org.
So chapter 4 is an interesting one. We've heard a lot about this today already. In a previous webinar with Comic Relief, they talked a lot about how they implement digital products as a means to sort of elevate their fundraising through cost savings. They have their whole build versus buy approach to technology, which has seen them reduce costs by almost 90% in some areas. But I don't want to steal too much of their thunder. You can go back and give that a listen when you get a chance, if you haven't had a chance to already. And of course, the second point being, we follow a digital revenue model ourselves, being sort of sponsor or advertising led. So how can charities, you know, make use of digital models like advertising models, subscription-based models, or completely new initiatives like Gaming for Good, for example?
Well, I think what I took from this chapter actually was the a couple of things, but first of all, just the sheer number of possible models that exists and that could be deployed for charities. Even I would have probably considered that Charity Digital had a relatively well evolved set of revenue models, and then looking at the chapter, I thought of a couple more that we may be able to explore. And I think there's always scope for redoing that exercise, relooking at what models you might be able to deploy within your organisation. The one that really captured my imagination on reading about it was online gaming and Gaming for Good, because the scale of it was beyond anything I could have I would have expected. I think Twitch is a leading gaming live stream channel that's generated $75 million since 2015. And Humble Bundle, which is old school games. And again, in there you pay what you feel you'd like to pay. And that's raised $134 million for not-for-profit since 2010. The scale of these was, and the fact that, I suppose, users are donating without probably really even realizing that they're donating to charity, I found very interesting, and I'm keen to think about how they could be used more.
I guess as CEO of Charity Digital, I've got to talk more about how we fund ourselves as well, because we do this big time. So the model that we've been running with the longest is actually our tech donation program model, where we get tech companies to donate a certain number of licenses of their technology, and then we charge a small admin fee, which covers our costs of providing access to those technologies. So that's quite a well-established model for us. More recently, we've been running Charity Digital News. We for quite a few years we kind of ran it on the side on a shoestring, and it didn't actually cover its costs. Obviously that isn't sustainable longer term. So the last couple of years we've had a much sharper focus on how we move to a sustainable model. And the answer to that has been, initially thought it was actually from an advertising model, but we've really evolved it. It is really more a sponsorship model, because anybody who knows who's active in the advertising field will know that things like display advertising are kind of dying, as consumers tend to ignore them nowadays. But a concept of sponsored content, and we have some of that. So some of the articles we produce today, actually, Digital Fundraising Day, we have some sponsors participating in this as well. And the concept we use here is that we have sponsors participating and paying to underwrite certain elements of content, and that then enables us to provide a lot of additional content totally free of charge to the sector as well. You've obviously got to have some balance in how you do that. You know, some people I know are probably very uncomfortable with relationships with commercial businesses because they feel it might compromise their independence. So we try and tread that line very carefully. But I think you can do it. And in terms of sustainability, it can be a very, very sustainable model. So I like it.
Absolutely. And particularly if you can set up a model where people are giving you money on a regular basis, whether it's a subscription or a membership fee or any kind of regular renewable income stream from members, that's particularly appealing, yeah. I think, for charities.
Yeah, membership fees can work really well. We actually spent some time when we were looking at the charity digital strategies to say, do we want to go down the membership fee route? It is a direction we could have gone in. We chose not to because we wanted to have a totally inclusive model,
sure,
where no charity would feel locked out. But there are other areas in which a membership model is going to be appropriate. And so I would say, you know, it kind of goes back, as I was saying at the opening, go back to your strategy. What are you looking to achieve? Who are you looking to achieve it for? And how best should you fund that?
Yeah.
Exactly. All fantastic points again. So on to chapter 5, which is challenge prize models. I feel this is kind of the most eccentric chapter that we had on our list, but if done well, I think it can be effective. Not only can it sort of mobilize revenue through sponsorship, but you know, again, like we've talked about previously, it can bring a real sense of community around a cause. But when might a charity consider this as sort of a viable financial model?
I suppose the classic case for challenger competitions is in a charity that's looking to generate kind of breakthrough thinking in its particular segment. So probably or an obvious example might be a medical research charity that really needs to come up with some genuinely innovative thinking from the market, and that's, yeah, and I suppose typically it would be funded therefore by a sponsor, and the advantage of this model is that it would allow a sponsor to pay only when results have been generated. So the idea, you set a challenge to the market, you receive a number of essentially free entries, free solutions, you set about the judging, and your sponsor only has to fund the winning entry. So a great way to associate yourself with breakthrough thinking in your particular segment, a great way to deliver results for a sponsor, sort of risk-free for both the charity and the sponsor, always, of course, providing that you've got the right level of interest and engagement from those who are putting forth solutions.
Yeah, it's interesting when you kind of look at the history of these models, actually, because they were really popular in the early 20th century. So there were prizes for being the first person to fly across the Channel and to fly across the Atlantic. And then they kind of went out of fashion for, you know, like 50, 60 years. And they seem to have recently come back. So Nestor are really active in this area. So one of the challenges they did was the Big Green Challenge, where they were looking for community-led responses to climate change. And they had 355 responses to this, and three winning teams got £300,000 as a prize and financial support to develop their ideas. So it can be a really effective model overall. But I guess there are some challenges to grapple with. In terms of, you know, you've got to get your publicity right so you grab people's imagination. Otherwise, you might have a very low level of response, or the level of responses just might not be very high quality. So that whole kind of marketing outreach to grab people's imagination and incentivize them to apply is what's going to be critical to the success of this.
And I suppose to help them really engage in the scale of the opportunity too, to make sure that they are incentivized to put the right level of effort into their entries. Otherwise, it could. There's always a risk that it could fall flat.
Yeah, I think this whole concept hinges on, you know, the fact you have to market it properly, and if you don't do that, you're kind of flogging a dead horse, for a better phrase. And that kind of makes a nice segue into our last chapter, actually, with you know, building engagement and empathy. Our last chapter digs into something that I imagine is a little closer to home for most charities. And that's how to get more donations from supporters. You know, fundraising and marketing are intrinsically linked, and marketing at a fundamental level is about, you know, building these positive, emotive connections, taking people on a journey, and making them feel that they're part of something bigger. But this is, you know, something that's talked about almost on an hourly basis across the sector. So what makes, you know, talking about engagement in this ebook stand out? What makes it different?
Yeah, as you say, Chris, we didn't want to just cover the same well-trodden ground again. So we actually took a slightly different orientation. And what we looked at here was the importance of avoiding compassion fatigue. You know, I think we've all seen lots and lots of campaigns, particularly around developing countries, where there's kind of pictures and images, terribly sad images of starving children, sick children, things like that. And they cause a massive emotional response and often raise a lot of money. But there are dangers in those approaches as well, which are well proven, in that donors can start to feel that their money won't actually make enough of a difference at the end of the day. And they give up. They get this this compassion fatigue. Whereas actually, the stats actually show that the impact of NGOs in these countries is huge, and poverty has been reduced significantly. So as a sector, we're making great steps overall.
But somehow those messages aren't reaching donors. Yeah. And I agree absolutely. What came across from this chapter for me was just that the desire from donors to feel like they're part of a solution, to see evidence of some of their donations having an impact, to see, you know, vaccinations reaching the children that they wanted to, or blankets, yeah, or what, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think blood.co.uk do that really well. You
know, they do.
You donate your blood, you get that text.
And it says, yeah, it's now reached Watford General Hospital,
yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly.
That makes it feel meaningful, doesn't it?
It does.
Absolutely. So that came across for me loud and clear. And there's so many opportunities now for charities to do that. So many digital channels, so many, you know, with videos, podcasts, webinars, etc. But using them to share positive messages, as well as the important, you know, the need.
Yeah. And I guess to give a negative example of an organisation that didn't do this in the US, Invisible Children had a massively successful campaign. It was based around a video. They doubled their revenues to $26 million in the space of a year. But the information that was actually in the video was ambiguous. It wasn't true, totally accurate and true at the end of the day. And when this started to emerge down the line, their revenue imploded, and a couple of years later they had to fold and go out of business altogether. So getting this right is really important.
Yeah, particularly for sustainability, which is the...
Exactly.
Well, let's draw a line there. I hate to sound cliche, but to find out more, go and read the ebook. By signing up for today, you do have access to it. Just head over to the agenda page at digitalfundraisingday.org.uk, and you can download your free copy. Well, thank you both for today. I felt that was a very productive chat.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area.
We'll be carrying on the Digital Fundraiser Day conversation on our Facebook group, Charity Digital Events. So if you're not joined up already, head over there to ask any questions that you have or chat with others who've been involved today. Big thanks to everybody today for joining us. Two things to look out for in the next few weeks. Our first virtual conference, and we'd love to hear what you thought of it. So please feel free to send in any feedback that you have. You can do so through our events mailbox, which is events@charitydigital.org.uk, through the Facebook group that I mentioned earlier, or from our online feedback form, which will be hitting your inboxes in the next few days. Other than that, we are extremely excited to announce our 2020 Be More Digital Conference, which will be held on March the 5th at Olympia Conference Centre. We hope to see you all in person then. Cheers, everybody, and see you soon.
Hey, it's Joel here from Charity Digital. Thanks for downloading the pod. If you haven't already, head over to charitydigitalnews.co.uk and join the 36,000 charities who are keeping ahead of the digital curve through articles, webinars, podcasts, and events. Register with us for free daily content.